From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. You'll be glad you did. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you've not pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Well, it's been another one of those weeks. All week long, unexpected news stories about criminal convictions for characters close to the president continued to make the present seem chaotic and the future uncertain. And once again, it's difficult to pull ourselves away from the car crash culture that our leaders seem to embrace so as to address issues of a more lasting but less shrieking nature. But that's what's most important for us to do right now. It's not to minimize what it means that Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen are now convicted felons. It's to never forget that leaders who are master media manipulators, even this level of failure and embarrassment, can be turned into a reality television episode that effectively distracts the public from the many dark goings-on that continue to erode the foundations of our nation. And what I mean is this. The surviving judicial structures of America worked. They trumped the cult of personality president to hold some of these closest associates accountable. It's right and proper that there's a lot of coverage and commentary of that fact, but it's the damage that's being done beneath the surface. It's what's happening to our culture, our courts, and our Constitution, accelerated by religious rhetoric that will have the most lasting effects. And so that's where we will continue to focus our attention this week. With that said, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Now, after crews had reinstalled the Ten Commandments monument on the Capitol grounds, the Satanic Temple came back with their own statue.
The group's rally for the First Amendment brought Satanists, Christians.
Different beliefs mostly came together to say all or none. If the Ten Commandments get to sit on Capitol grounds, so do the statues of their representative religions.
Earlier this month, the bedrock principle of church-state separation received the provocative support of an 8-foot statue of Baphomet, a goat-headed devil figure. It happened in Arkansas, and the context was the Satanic Temple standing up to religious right lawmakers attempting to Roy Moore the state capitol grounds by putting up a Ten Commandments monument. We'll dig deeper into this story with Temple spokesman Lucian Greaves.
Interfaith engagement is a really kind of easy way to make people understand that people are human.
We agreed on 90% of the stuff we talked about. We believed in the same thing. We believed in the same message of peace, harmony, love, respect.
Dividing people along religious lines is a technique as old as religion itself. It's a technique that's been used to conquer, to control, to destroy great nations throughout history. And we've seen it weaponized in this country in ways that are both effective and terrifying. Audaciously countering those attempts is the One American Movement. Now, we've featured the work of this organization before, and I'm looking forward to welcoming Director Andrew Hanauer back to State of Belief Radio later in the hour. But first,
Sister Simone, nuns on the bus are headed to Mar-a-Lago. Yes, the nuns on the bus on the road to Mar-a-Lago, because what we want to do is collect the stories of ordinary people who are so victimized by this tax policy and take it to the icon of who benefits from this tax policy and say, hey, this is not who we are as a nation. Let's come together and work for the common good.
It's been a remarkably effective, if simple, means to raise moral voices of faith in defense of the poor and the marginalized. Catholic sisters boarding a bus and heading across the country. Since the first Nuns on the Bus campaign back in 2012, we've brought you the first person insights of organizer Sister Simone Campbell of the Network Lobby. Well, buckle up, because the nuns will ride again this fall. I'm delighted to be joined once again by Sister Simone. Simone, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's so good to be with you, Weldon.
The nuns on the bus are heading to Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, I'm really excited about the trip, because what we're trying to do is to educate people about this horrible tax policy that was passed by the Congress in December of 2017, and we want to educate people about it and then hold their elected officials accountable. But the best part of it is this title for me, because it's the juxtaposition of nuns and Mar-a-Lago. Hmm. Mar-a-Lago is the icon of who benefits from this tax policy, and I hope that us as nuns, that we stand out for caring for those who are struggling in the economic margins of our society. So it's going to be a great trip.
There are lots of stops on this itinerary. You're starting October 8th in L.A. How did the map for this trip come together?
Well, what we did was we looked at where were the places where representatives or senators had voted for the tax bill and also voted for the repeal of health care. Hmm. And when we found where they were, then we said, well, we have to go hold them accountable. So that's kind of what you see. We tried to hit as many of them as we could. The other piece of it is I'm with my community in Los Angeles the weekend before we start. So it also went with my community's dates for meetings. But we thought it was great to go from one coast to the other and lifting up this story that the common good, the benefit of all of us, means that we need to change this tax policy.
I know you not only bring a message on each of these trips, but it's also very much a listening tour. I remember a lot of the stories that you've told on the air and with us talking. What will you be asking the people you meet along your way to Florida?
Well, it's really about understanding the needs of local communities and then hearing what their worries are. One of the things that I've heard just traveling by myself is how concerned people are about health care, about wages, about the capacity to have affordable housing. So those are some things we know, but in each jurisdiction, each area, it's a little different. And so the benefit of the bus is to come with a message, but also as learners to receive their story and then demonstrate how the tax bill relates to their worries. Because here's one of the troubles with the tax bill. Usually when I say, oh, I'm going to talk about taxes, everybody's eyes glaze over and they think, oh, no, ugh, terrible. But it is at the center of what funds all of our shared common concerns. And this is what we want to hear from the local communities, like, how's your infrastructure? How's your education? How's your food distribution? What are you worried about? And then connect it to the tax policy so people see these aren't separate issues. They're integrally connected.
You worked like crazy on that tax bill.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. And in fact, Weldon, one of the things that fueled this desire to engage the tax bill was the utter frustration that the bad choice made by Congress. We worked so hard to stop it or to change it or to make it work for the common good. But there was no room. It was just rammed through in a very short period of time without listening to anyone. There were no hearings held on this issue. No one would receive the data we had brought from around the country. That's what sort of made me mad and said, we have to do something. And then when a colleague of mine said, well, you could go to Mar-a-Lago, and I got to be on the bus, on the road to Mar-a-Lago. So that just gave me joy in my heart. Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm excited about is in Mar-a-Lago, we're going to do it, well, we think we're going to do this. We have to get a permit, but mm-hmm. a parade for the common good and end with a fiesta for the common good. Mm. It's the antithesis of the tax policy. It will be all of us working together for the good of all.
I think it's fair to say that you weren't shy about addressing Paul Ryan due to both his leadership role and his Catholic affiliation. The Vice President of the United States is Catholic as well. Does that give you any hope that your message might be better heard by this administration? Or are you able to talk about that?
Well, quite frankly, it is very difficult to break through. Paul Ryan has a total misunderstanding of our Catholic faith, and he's not willing to meet with me anymore since he became Speaker, and so I haven't had a chance to personally talk to him, but I have sent him a number of letters with Pope Francis's statements and his exhortations so that he hears what actually is true Catholic social teaching. Paul Ryan thinks, and I believe Vice President Pence thinks, that this is about individualism, mm-hmm. and that's the furthest thing from the truth. The principle is all about how we are in shared relationship with each other, and we hold a duty of care to each other. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been too successful in communicating that effectively in order to change his mind, mm-hmm. but I'll keep at it. I'm not stopping, that's for sure. I'm kind of stubborn when it comes to this message.
Simone, what's the role for lay people who are inspired by the nuns on the bus between now and October? What should they do to participate or support the campaign?
Well, I'll be very blunt. I'm still raising money for this thing, so contributions are gratefully appreciated. But more importantly, in many ways, is to begin to pay attention to the coming November election. Mm-hmm. And where was your representative in these really important votes? Finding out what are the worries in your community. You know, each individual, each listener knows what he or she is worried about. But talk to your neighbors. Get a shared sense of what's of concern in your neighborhood. Too often these days, in this horribly polarized, painful, painful time, we're frightened to talk to each other about important things, like, mm-hmm. what are you worried about? So I encourage people to exercise holy curiosity, finding out what your neighbors know or think or believe, and then sacred gossip. Share mm-hmm. what you hear. Let it be known. Spread it around. This is how we create community. And check out our website, nunsonthebus.org. And we're going to be populating our schedule with details. We've got where we're going, but we don't have all of the events up yet. So if we're coming to your neighborhood, and there's a good chance that we are for a bunch of folks around the country, check it out. See the dates we're going to be there. And then come show up. Sign the bus. Be a part of us.
So if someone wanted to make a financial contribution, say again where they should send that.
Okay, so two ways to do it. At nunsonthebus.org, there's a donate button if you want to do it online, or it also gives you our mailing address at nunsonthebus.org, and it's 25 E Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. Mm-hmm. We'd love to have anybody participate in any way. Finances would be gratefully appreciated.
Simone, you've spoken movingly about the clergy sexual abuse Pennsylvania grand jury recently yeah. exposed. This is so painful for so many people. Would you mind sharing your thoughts on this tragedy and on what needs to happen going forward?
Oh, my glory. Well, then you're absolutely right. This is anguish. This is anguish. I just wanted to weep reading about the Pennsylvania report, but thanks be to God it's brought into the light. I mean, the scriptures say the truth will set us free, but I always add, first, it's going to scare us to death. Mm-hmm. And I think that the truth of this is horrifying. Mm-hmm. But at least with the truth, we can make change. And what Pope Francis called for in the letter that he issued to the entire world was the challenge to a culture of clericalism that protected priests more than engaging in the people and caring for the people, caring for those who were abused and the children. So we need, within the Catholic Church, a dramatic change of culture, and it's been coming little by little, but it's gotten stalled in what I see as a conservative return to hierarchy and clericalism, and that's what we have to step away from. We have to return to the Church of the Gospel.
So are you optimistic that the hierarchy understands the need for this level of self-examination and commitment to change?
Yes and no. Depends on the person. They're sort of like Paul Ryan and the vice president. The challenge is the human reality.
Yeah.
That it's easier to point fingers than to own our own need for conversion. That's true for me, too. So I'm hopeful that we can all, as a church, come together and acknowledge our own need for conversion and to then step into a new reality. Pope Francis is challenging us to do that. And for me, the best way to do it is by caring for those who are in need in our society. Mm-hmm. Let's come together and do what Jesus did. Walk towards those who are in need.
When you look at the world in which we're living, and more particularly the government that we are trying to negotiate and change, what's your attitude these days?
It depends which moment you're talking to me. Some moments I just want to pull the covers over my head and hide. But the other piece is what that says to me, this is the time for continued deep engagement with people, that it's people that make the difference. It's caring for each other. And I know that the Holy Spirit works in these challenging times to wake us up. So quite frankly, my prayer is about a new Pentecost. We may be hidden in the upper room, kind of afraid to go out, but I also think we're getting stirred up and pushed out, that our message is more needed than ever. So we need to say, to proclaim that Jesus' message about love one another, even our enemies, we got to love them. So in love, we can make this change happen. But luckily, we each have a good day every now and then. So I'm counting on you to have a good day, and then when I have my good day, I'll share it with you, and we together can bolster each other and create the community that we're called to.
Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of the Network Catholic Lobby and author of the book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. The sisters are getting back on the bus this October 8th in Los Angeles and crossing the country on their way to Mar-a-Lago, Florida. More information is available at nunsonthebus.org. I hope we'll talk again before you get on the bus, but for sure I want to wish you a good trip this October and thank you again for being a friend and for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. It's an honor to do this work, and I'm so grateful for your service. It's a treasure.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear about a provocative action on behalf of the U.S. Constitution in Arkansas. And up next, Andy Anauer, director of the inspiring One America Movement. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Our country is fractured. Americans are frustrated. We can do better. That simple statement launched a movement to bring Americans together again across the deep divides, some deliberately created, that scars the soul of our nation right now. In May of last year, One America Movement director Andrew Hanauer was with us to share what sounded like an almost impossible optimistic plan. And it's high time to have him back with us. Andy, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me again.
Would you start by just refreshing our memory about the origins of the One America movement and what the vision was for this organization?
Absolutely. Our origins are that we were founded by faith leaders who were very concerned about the state of our country, the direction that we're going. And our work is really simple. We believe that bringing our country together cannot be separated from the really deep challenges we face: poverty, racism, opioids. And so what we do is bring Americans together, not just to talk, not to sort of just be civil, but to do profoundly important work together, to work on the issues that really matter, and in so doing, build the kind of relationships that can fight back against really divisive narratives that we see in our country.
Andy, what made you want to do this? What was the inspiration?
Probably because I'm crazy, but I think for me, like many American families, I've got folks from all different sides, walks of life, religions within my extended family. So for me, in a personal note, I'm really resonates with me what Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute said recently, when he said that if, when you hate somebody, you're probably hating somebody that I love, no matter which side of the aisle it's on. But from a larger perspective, I think that we've really been missing some key things in this country in our sort of rush to pick a team and be involved in sort of very hyper-partisan work. And I think that what we've been missing is that, you know, we have some really serious problems, and it's very hard to solve problems when all we're focused on is sort of political victory. And so I think, you know, for me, I wanted to see work done that brought people together, again, not just to get along, but to really see if we could find ways to solve problems that actually impact people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really motivated me to want to do this work.
Andy, I have to tell you, one bright spot in my email inbox is the monthly newsletter from the One America Movement. So I want to thank you for that, but I also to ask you to talk about some of the highlights you've been able to share in the past couple of months.
Sure, and thanks for not unsubscribing. You know, so we've been running projects around the country, and they've been really, really powerful for me personally to be there when I'm there, and also just for the participants, of course, themselves. We run a number of long-term programs that bring Americans together over a long course of time to work together on issues that impact them, and one of those is our work in West Virginia, where we're bringing together folks from West Virginia with communities in Washington, D.C. We're bringing Black and white, Jewish, Muslim, evangelical Christians, Democrats, Republicans, working together to combat the opioid epidemic, which is really devastating, not just West Virginia, but the African-American community in Washington, D.C. And so we're really trying to create a project that not only brings people together and not only helps fight addiction, but transforms the long-standing narrative in our country that drug addiction in Black communities is a criminal offense, whereas drug addiction in white communities is something to be treated. And we're doing something that brings those communities together to show a better way.
Yeah.
And we've been doing projects around the country that bring Americans together for service and meals and conversations to address poverty and homelessness in Salt Lake City and Tulsa and Los Angeles. So we're trying to get out there as much as we can.
Andy, I think our listeners would love to hear you talk about the iftar at a synagogue in Utah.
Yeah. So an iftar is the breaking of the fast during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And it's, you know, event where once the sun goes down, folks eat for the first time that day. And so we did an iftar at a synagogue after Friday night services in Utah. And from what we're told, this is the first time this has ever happened in the state of Utah. I think what makes me really excited about it, though, is that in a lot of American communities, American Muslims and American Jews have relationships with each other. They They do a lot of things together. But in this case, these folks were really meeting each other for the first time. And they were meeting each other during a time of conflict in Israel-Palestine. And so we had a number of people at that event say that they had never sat down and really talked with a member of the other group before. And I think it was really positive. It was the first step. And those groups are going to continue engaging each other over the course of the next year.
Mm. Your initiatives are so specific and so easy to understand. I think that is so critically important at a time like this. Now that you've been doing this for a while, can you share some lessons learned about the kinds of initiatives that work best and what makes them compelling for people to take part?
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, what we've been doing since we started is really basing our work on the advice and the research of social scientists, neuroscientists, conflict resolution experts, academics, people who have been studying how human beings come into conflict as part of groups, and how those groups can move away from conflict and violence. And so one of the things that we based our work on is this idea of creating identities that cut across divides. So, you know, someone's a Republican, someone else is a Democrat. It's very unlikely that they will ever stop being a Republican or a Democrat. But they can be a Republican and a Democrat who are also part of a One America movement. And that's really critical, because when we stop having those types of identities that cut across, whether it's One America or a religion or a membership of a, you know, in a state or a city, where we stop feeling connection to people who are, you know, in some sort of opposite group, that's when polarization really takes off. So in all of our projects, we don't attempt to sort of have civil dialogue around politics, but rather do things outside of the political realm where there's shared values and where we can create a connection. And that then can get us to a point where we can address political issues as well. But we don't want to start by just activating the part of the brain that is politically wired, because it actually activates the polarization that already exists in us.
Mm-hmm. Where are you active across the country?
So we have active work in Los Angeles, Utah, Oklahoma, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Texas, and Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear what you say when you run into new people and introduce them to the One America movement to try to get them interested in this. What's your pitch? What's your speech to them about why they need to be involved in this?
Sure. I mean, the reality is that so many people have different entry points to this.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a lot of Muslim Americans, our pitch is that all the research shows that one of the biggest factors in whether or not an American likes Muslims is whether or not they've met one.
Mm-hmm.
And our projects are designed to bring American Muslims and non-Muslims into contact with each other in ways that we actually have survey data showing that polarization between those groups reduces. For a lot of our evangelical Christian communities, they've always felt alienated from interfaith work. They feel like it doesn't speak to them, like they're asked to subsume their beliefs and identities. Our pitch to them is that this is a place where you have the platform and space to express your beliefs and your faith fully in the way that you do. Just know that it's going to be expressed from other folks as well. And so I think those pitches are sort of very different. But I think our overall pitch is that our country's in a lot of trouble. We have a very divisive political system and society that, if left unchecked, can lead us to very dark places.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need now more than ever are initiatives that bring people together, again, not just to get along, but to fundamentally transform how our country's society and politics are wired. And that's exactly what our organization does.
I'm curious, are you optimistic or pessimistic about where we're going?
I'm optimistic always, but I'm also realistic. And I'm realistic about the fact that this is a monumental challenge. we cannot think that we are exceptional and that the things that have happened in other countries won't happen here. And a lot of the dynamics of polarization they're not isolated dynamics. They're dynamics that then feed into authoritarianism, dehumanization, hate, violence, and eventually lead us to things like ethnic cleansing or genocide. Mm. So I'm not trying to be alarmist and say, you know, we're on the brink of genocide. But what I am saying is that if we don't address this now, if we do not have substantive investment in work to reduce these dynamics and stop them, I do fear for our country. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have an opportunity. I think the 2016 election showed us sort of just how bad the problem was. But now we have to take that opportunity. We need to really invest in this work.
How can our listeners get involved in the One America movement?
Yeah, thank you. So our website is oneamericamovement.org. You can join the movement by signing up online. Very simple. Certainly, we appreciate financial donations as well. But we're also on the brink of launching both a new website and a way for folks to start a chapter in their area. So I think that's going to be coming online very soon, and I think will be a way that people can get involved at their local level.
Andrew Hedauer is director of the One America Movement, bringing Americans together across racial, religious, political, and geographic divides to address pressing social problems, to do the address together. Learn more at oneamericamovement.org. Andy, I love what you're doing, admire the work that you're doing, and I love what you're saying. Thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Little Rock lawmakers have been hell-bent to erect a Ten Commandments monument on the Arkansas State Capitol grounds. There's been a constitutional response from secular activists from the ACLU and from people of faith who know the risks of conflating religion and politics. And now the response includes an 8-foot bronze statue of a figure with the head of a goat. That's the bold statement from the Satanic Temple earlier this month, and I'm joined right now by Temple co-founder Lucian Greaves. Lucian, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
By all accounts, the protest August 16th in Little Rock was a success. Nonviolent, well-attended, and broadly covered in the press. Talk briefly about what happened on that day, if you would.
Well, we had put together this rally, and we were hoping to put forward the message that we weren't actually protesting to have the Ten Commandments monument taken down. The Ten Commandments monument having to be taken down would be an outcome of the state insisting that they would only accept one religious monument. What we were essentially saying is that if they were to accept our monument, they would legalize the Ten Commandments monument. They would have really made the Capitol grounds a free speech zone for private donations of religious significance. And in that way, none of the secular groups, none of the alternative religious groups would have anything to complain about. And the state of Arkansas just isn't having that, mm-hmm. of course. So we did get reach out in an interfaith manner to people from other religious groups. We cast kind of a wide net, but we ended up having a couple Christian ministers speak on our behalf in favor of separation of church and state, in favor of pluralism. And that was something I felt got lost in a lot of the press. Mm-hmm. And while the rally was carried out, as you say, and there wasn't any violence, it was a really weird atmosphere. There were a lot of people with guns milling about, and I noticed people trailing me, people who were clearly armed on my way up to the staging platform. And I had a 8-man security team, and they kind of got me in and got me out right away. But there was definitely an air of impending violence, and I'm glad nothing nothing bad did happen, but it was a really kind of bizarre, and it felt like a dangerous event.
My goodness. So what do you think was achieved?
Well, hopefully, I think if anybody did listen to the words said at the rally, if anybody bothered to look at any of the consistent messaging we've put out, and I think more and more people do become exposed to this the more we do these things, the more they'll realize that the state is outright lying to them. The state puts out this propaganda now, and they're really playing a rotten game. You know, mm-hmm. Where they filed a motion against our intervener to join the lawsuits, the Ten Commandments lawsuits in Arkansas, and all they did was attack our authenticity as a religious organization. Hmm. And that's not even a topic of discussion, or shouldn't be in this case at all, regardless of what you feel our religious expression, whether it's really validated in somebody else's mind as a legitimate religious practice, is a moot point, given especially the fact that the state has been arguing that the Ten Commandments monument isn't a religious monument. It's supposed to be merely historical or legalistic. You know, it's supposed to speak to the codification of American law, even given the fact that the Ten Commandments directly contradict the Constitution of the United States. So for them to then turn around and say that our monument doesn't deserve placement because they don't view us as a legitimate religion calls into question their entire argument and just how disingenuous they've been approaching this whole thing to begin with. So I think when people kind of see those discrepancies and they see that everything they've heard about us is a lie because they've been hearing that we're simply mocking Christianity or that we're poking a thumb in the eye of believers of the state or that it's outsiders against the state of Arkansas, secularists versus believers or whatever else. That really gives the lie to that when we hold an interfaith rally that pays respect to pluralism in the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Years and years ago in Louisville, Kentucky, I had to go get papers in order to do weddings. Actually, Arkansas has to do the same thing. And while I was there that day, someone from the Satanic Temple there came in and wanted to get their authority to do weddings. And the person that was representing the state said, ask the question, do you believe in God? Because that's the way we're going to decide this. And the person who was there from the temple said, yes, we believe in God. We're against him. And he said, then you can get the papers. Now, was that a good answer, or was that a stereotype that would bother anybody?
Well, I mean, it kind of bothers me. We're very clearly non-theistic in our religion.
Sure.
And some people say, well, then that's just a little ploy to say you're an activist atheist using religion as some kind of trolling tool or whatever else. I don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. I will fight my dying breath for the legitimacy of non-theistic religion. And I think that in the future, we're going to see a lot more people of mainstream religions identifying with the religion non-theistically, meaning they don't believe in the supernatural elements, but they still have a sense of cultural attachments to whatever religious upbringing they had, whatever rites are associated with it, holidays, or what the sense of ethics. A lot of people leave their religion, they feel a real sense of loss because they mm-hmm. feel they've given up that sense of community, they've given up that ethics, they've given up that contextualization of their life and their goals. It doesn't have to be that way. You can still live a reasoned life, you can still have that kind of cultural attachment. And to be clear, there's a large Jewish population that already does this. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people are well aware of the large population of secular Jews that still practice their traditional rites or whatever else, their holidays, but they simply don't believe in those archaic superstitions that are mm-hmm. often attached to their religious identification. And I think we're going to start seeing that a lot more and more. And I still think, though, that non-theistic religion can really speak to somebody's deeply held beliefs in mm-hmm. such a way that they should be able to make that case in court if mm-hmm. they feel that the government is imposing upon their sense of identity in such a way that they just cannot comply. Maybe they should have some kind of recourse to make that type of argument. And I don't think your capacity to do that, to fight for your deeply held beliefs, should be diminished simply because you don't believe in the supernatural. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I wouldn't say that I believe in God and that I'm against him. I would mm-hmm. say, no, I don't believe in God, but I absolutely do believe in the ethics we put forward due to our religious attachment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, tell me, I'm curious about and I can't pronounce, I'm not sure I can pronounce the name. Tell me the name and tell me about why that's there.
Well, the name is Baphomet, and the image is based off of a drawing by an occult historian from the 19th century, Eliphas Levi. The Sabbatic goat has this goat head, human body, and it has all these binary elements. And in modern times, in modern Satanism, it's kind of been recognized as a Satanized idol. You know, Satanists kind of gravitated towards this previously pagan Sabbatic goat image. And we felt that this was a perfect image to kind of symbolize what we were trying to put forward with this notion of pluralism and intolerance and mm-hmm. enlightenment values and free speech because of those binary elements, because it's part animal, part human, points above, points below, is supposedly hermaphroditic and all these other things. It has the caduceus in the middle representing negotiation and reconciliation. And we thought that that idea of the reconciliation of the opposites spoke really well to our cause, and the fact that we never asked to have this monument put up in isolation to the exclusion of other religious voices. Mm-hmm. We only want our monument on public grounds where there's a Ten Commandments monument, where there's other pre-existing monuments of religious significance, because it symbolizes that kind of reconciliation of the opposites. It symbolizes pluralism. Mm-hmm. It's made complete by the presence of the Ten Commandments monument near it. It shows that there can be multiple different perspectives coexisting on the same grounds, even if they're ostensibly diametrically opposed. They don't have to be at war with one another. They're reconciled together on the public grounds where the government remains viewpoint neutral.
Mm-hmm. The Satanic Temple has spearheaded this kind of action in other states in the past. Let me ask you an either or both and question. Is the objective more about recruiting new members and promoting your beliefs, or is it about defending the Constitution against sectarian partisan attempts to tear down the wall of separation?
Oh, it really is pushing back. It's being on the front lines and fighting back against impending theocracy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's overly hysterical to say that moves like this, moves to put up a exclusive Ten Commandments monument to the exclusion of other religious viewpoints, is a step towards theocracy, because mm-hmm. it is. Yeah. That's not a small step, and that redefines who we are as America, and it's something we need to push back against every step of the way. And frankly, we're not hurting for recruitment. We don't go and we don't proselytize. Mm-hmm. We don't go and tell people that Satanism is right for them, because mm-hmm. it might not be. That goes against everything we stand for. People have the right to the freedom to follow their own conscience wherever it might lead. It's nice to us that people know where we're coming from and can distinguish mm-hmm. what we actually believe from the mythology, the satanic panic mythology they might hear. But the last thing on our mind is going out and saying we need to increase our membership or anything like that. We grew really fast in a real short period of time, and it's enough to manage just where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. Lucian, I was surprised by this and want to ask, the ACLU resisted having the temple sign on to its lawsuit in Arkansas. Why do you think they did that?
Well, it might not necessarily be that the ACLU has an objection to the nature of our case.
Mm-hmm.
According to them, you know, they think that our case is different enough that it will overly complicate the case to have our case merged in with theirs. And that's what we motioned to do. We motioned what's called an intervener so that our case would essentially be merged with the case of the ACLU, the Arkansas Freethinkers, and the Freedom from Religion Foundation. The other parties didn't object. Only the ACLU did. And they might just have their tactical reasons for that. Because even though the facts are the same in our complaint, the remedy we're seeking is different. We're the one party that's not asking for the Ten Commandments monument to be taken down. We're asking for our monument to go up. Of course, the natural outcome is if they refuse to put our monument up, that theirs would naturally have to come down as well. So there's both the similarities and the differences. Or it may just be that the ACLU's plaintiffs wanted nothing to do with it, objected, and the ACLU is speaking on their behalf. One way or the other, though, if our intervener isn't accepted to be merged in their cases, we will file our own separate lawsuit, and we are still going to litigate this. And I guarantee you, we're going to win. The Ten Commandments monument, I don't think for a moment they're going to put our monument up. You know, that's where we stand on principle. That's what we're asking for. But I think the real outcome here is that the Ten Commandments monument has no chance of staying up. There isn't precedent that supports this. The precedent they're citing that has allowed some Ten Commandments monuments to stay up across the United States just does not apply here. And I think it would be very difficult for a judge to justify this in any way at all.
Lucian Greaves is co-founder of the Satanic Temple, which has stepped up repeatedly to challenge the bedrock constitutional principle of the separation of church and state. Any church and state in our nation. Lucian, I appreciate the work that you're doing on church-state separation, the spirit in which you're doing it, and I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I love being on. Thank you. Anytime.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Step up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.